Earlier this year, a woman from Utah and a man from Wyoming were both exonerated after having spent a combined 40 years in prison. Both cases are due in large part to the work of the Rocky Mountain Innocence Center, located here in Salt Lake City. Today I'm joined in the studio by Jennifer Hare Salem, Executive Director of the Rocky Mountain Innocence Project, and Jency Anderson, Legal Director for the Center and a Clinical Professor of Law at the University of Utah, to discuss their organization and these recent successes. Thanks for being here today, both of you.
Thank you for having us.
To start, Jennifer, can you explain for our listeners just what is the Rocky Mountain Innocence Center, and can you tell me how it came to be?
Right. Well, the Rocky Mountain Innocence Center is a nonprofit organization. It's an independent nonprofit organization that works in collaboration with law schools in the state of Nevada and Utah and Wyoming. And our mission is to correct and prevent the wrongful convictions of people who are innocent in those three states.
And how about the sort of history of the organization? When did it start?
Back in 2000, there was a perceived need for the reexamination of certain cases. We were starting to see nationally with DNA testing that there was solid evidence in many cases that there were people who were innocent behind bars. And so no organization like ours existed in the Western region. And Lionel Frankel, who was a professor at the law school here at the University of Utah, really had it in his heart to do something about that and begin to investigate these cases and collaborate with law students at the University of Utah to do some research investigation. And then when it comes time to these cases having an opportunity to get back into court, we work with the partnership of attorneys in the community on a pro bono basis.
Jency, as the legal director, maybe you can explain this part. How many people have you represented, and how do you decide to take cases? How does that process work?
Over the years, we've represented probably over 100 people, at least through an investigative stage. We're very strict in the way that we handle these cases. We get about 20 to 25 requests for assistance every month.
Oh, wow.
And at that stage, we make sure that they're claiming actual innocence. Sometimes it's difficult to tell from the letters we receive. So we err on the side of sending them what we call our questionnaire. So we send our questionnaire to anyone who's requested assistance. It's about a 25-page questionnaire, and we send that along with very detailed information about the kinds of cases that we take. We ask them to fill that back and fill it out and send it back to us. After that, about 50% of those questionnaires come back. At that point, we look at those questionnaires. Someone in our office looks at those questionnaires. They see if the claim of innocence, if it is a claim of innocence, which it must be. I mean, we're not looking at cases that are, I had a bad lawyer or just that the evidence was mishandled, but that I'm truly innocent, that I had nothing to do with this crime. So it goes through an initial screening. Once it goes through that initial screening, about 50% of the cases are knocked out at that point. At that point, it goes to a committee on our board called the Legal Committee that's made up of lawyers who have some experience in post-conviction work. And at that point, we make a decision about whether we're willing to take the case into investigation. And we take about 4 to 6 cases into investigation per year. In a DNA case, the average is about 2 to 4 years of investigation before we're ready to go to court. And in a non-DNA case, it's decades.
Wow, decades. Mm-hmm. That's a long time. I'm wondering about if do you talk about the requests for examination of a case or for investigation, but do you guys ever of your own accord go and seek out people who you think no okay so I see heads shaking.
That's fine. I'm sorry, I could answer.
Yes, yeah. Forget that we're on the radio.
Yeah.
Okay, so here's a question: how many exonerations have you guys been responsible for?
We've had 4 exonerations in the last 11 years,
wow.
2 DNA exonerations and 2 non-DNA exonerations.
So that's interesting. I'd like to talk about that, the different ways that there are exonerations. Two of your recent cases highlight the different ways you seek justice for those wrongfully imprisoned and ways in which people can be exonerated. I want to start with the Andrew Johnson case. Can you tell me a bit about how the Rocky Mountain Innocence Project got involved and how he was freed?
Andrew wrote to us in about 2002, and we took on his case because it was a pretty typical, if you will, DNA single perpetrator rape case. And he went through our process, but ultimately we agreed to take his case on for investigation. when we took the case on for investigation, there was absolutely no law in Wyoming that would allow him to get back in court, whether the DNA existed or not. We actually, within about 2 or 3 years, were able to discover that DNA did exist in his case that could be tested to show whether he was innocent or not. Unfortunately, we spent hundreds and hundreds of hours doing legal research on ways to get back into court. And that's one of the problems with these innocence cases is you just don't get to go back into court. There has to be a mechanism to do that. And at that time, Wyoming had no such mechanism. And as Jennifer said, one of the things that we do is not only help people to come home from prison if they're innocent, but really look at the system and see how we can fix it. And we not only look at reforms to the system, but also that get innocent people into prison in the first place, but also ways to get them back into court should they have evidence that proves they're innocent. So in 2008, we went to the Wyoming legislature and proposed a DNA testing law. It was passed then. Andrew had decided to do some work on his own at that point, but in 2012, he came back to us and asked that we file a case on his behalf. The reason his case took longer than most DNA cases was simply because there was absolutely no way to get him back into court until that DNA law was passed.
And so advocating for that law, for the reform, is that something you do often?
Yes. Okay. We do. Not only do we do the legal work, but we do education work to try to let let people know about wrongful convictions. But we also do a lot of policy work. We not only got a DNA testing law passed in Wyoming, but we also got one passed in Nevada. We also got an evidence preservation statute passed in Nevada because one of the problems in this case is actually the preservation of evidence. And we were also we also helped with the DNA testing law here in Utah, as well as a compensation law here in Utah, and what we call the non-DNA statute, which allows people who do not have DNA evidence back into court.
And this is people who are factually innocent, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's something I want to talk about. Andrew Johnson's case was based largely on DNA evidence, but another case that was here in Utah was Deb Brown's case. Can you tell me a little bit about Deb Brown's case?
Yeah, Deb's case came to us in 2002 as well. At the outset, it looked like there may be DNA evidence, and we took the case because of that, but we knew that it was going to be a tough case, that it was a purely circumstantial case. There was no direct evidence connecting her to the crime. We were able to do some DNA testing in that case in 2005, and although it helped the case, it didn't solely prove her innocence. So we needed to go forward, but at that point it was clear that it was what we call a non-DNA case, that there was going to be no other testable evidence, so that we were going to have to come up with something pretty compelling in order to get her out of prison. And again, we were facing the problem that there was no law that would allow us to get back into court. Nonetheless, we continued to investigate her case. The primary thing that convicted Deborah was that the time of death of the victim. She had an alibi for the entire weekend that the victim was killed, except for a 2 hour period between 7 and 9 Saturday morning. The prosecution worked very hard to show that the death occurred during that time, and because of that, that was one of the main reasons Deborah Brown was convicted. We were ultimately able to locate witnesses who saw the victim later that day at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and again at 7 o'clock at night, which means he couldn't have been killed at 7 in the morning, which means Deborah could not have been the perpetrator. Hmm. So that ultimately, along with a bunch of other evidence, was what exonerated Deborah Brown.
That's fascinating. I mean, so those are the two different sides we're looking at. But can we talk a little bit about those two camps? You have one where there's very hard scientific evidence, and then another case where you have, I guess I'm wondering, what are the differences between trying to deal with those two cases?
When the Innocence Movement began, most of the Innocence Projects were just looking at DNA cases. The problem with that is DNA exists in only about 5 to 10% of criminal cases. Physical evidence that can be tested is only available in 5 to 10% of criminal cases. In the other 90 to 95% of cases, there'll have to be something else that will prove innocence if indeed the person is innocent. We as an organization made the decision at the outset that we were going to look at both kinds of cases. Although the non-DNA cases are incredibly difficult, they take much longer, and the successes are more difficult to achieve, we felt that it was really important not to leave that 90% behind. And so, you know, DNA, we call the DNA cases the easy cases, if you will. They're, of course, not easy. They still take time.
Right.
They still take a fight. But the DNA, the non-DNA cases take much longer. They take that old-fashioned kind of sleuthing. We have to put the case back together. We have to figure out where a client was convicted. And then we have to figure out what may or may not prove innocence. And we may not know that until we really get into the investigation. And we often go down roads that end up at a brick wall. And then we back up and start down another road. And we really don't give up until we feel like we've overturned every stone that could possibly bring the person to justice.
Jennifer, I want to bring you back into the conversation here. I'm wondering about how you got involved in the organization. I mean, what was it that drew you to working on something that is, to some extent humanitarian, but it's also about justice and seeing injustices righted? Why are you involved in this?
Well, me personally.
Yeah, personally.
Personally. Well, I'm clergy in the United Methodist Church and was drawn to my ordination calling because of issues of social justice. Those have always been very near and dear to my heart. As a local pastor, that was something that I focused on greatly. And then I worked in the area of homelessness for a number of years. And this position opened up. And, like I said, issues of social justice I'm very passionate about. This was an organization looking for an executive director at the time to help develop the organization. We had received some federal funding, and that funding was not guaranteed into the future, and it was clear that the organization needed somebody to move forward in terms of funds development and advancing the infrastructure of the organization. So I was blessed with this opportunity to serve as their executive director, and it's been very fulfilling. One of the things that I want to get out there, I guess, is the statistic that's striking to me, that nationally between 3% and 6% of people in prison are innocent. That's hundreds and thousands of people. And in a country where we pride ourselves on, you know, the best justice system in the world, that's just not something that we can stand for.
I want to ask you guys, I'm taking like right turns, left turns here, going all over the place, but how do wrongful convictions happen? I mean, I know that there's pressure to convict, society wants to see justice. What are the reasons that that wrongful convictions happen?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question. One of our missions is absolutely to bring people home from prison who are innocent, but the other is to look at why they got into prison in the first place. So there, we've been doing a lot of studying and looking at issues that could possibly help to reform the system. The major cause of wrongful conviction in this country is mistaken eyewitness ID. We found that in 75% of the DNA cases, there was a mistaken eyewitness. And so what we've been doing is trying to look at reforms with regards to eyewitness identification, ways to really guarantee that if an eyewitness is going to testify, that their testimony is credible and reliable. So that's one of the major reasons. We also see police and prosecutor misconduct. We see defense attorney misconduct. We see false confessions. We see false forensic science being used. And part of that is that forensic science has made such leaps since every year almost it makes leaps. And so in some instances, it was just that the science wasn't available at the time. But in other instances, it really was science that really isn't science that was used to convict someone.
Well, is it maybe misinterpretation of what evidence tells you? That's interesting. And so and are juries, because of the sort of TV culture that we have, are they susceptible to thinking this is obviously black or white hard science, and so therefore if they're telling me that this shows that, then he must be guilty, kind of thing?
I think that was the case actually before the sort of television revolution of all of these CSI kinds of programs. In the past, with regards to hair, they would look at one hair and then they'd look at another hair and they'd either say they matched or they didn't. And that science, if you will, has been totally debunked, that you cannot look at one hair and another hair and decide if they come from the same source or not. It simply cannot be done. It is not science.
Right.
Now, I think juries demand better science. They demand more science. They want to know if there are those two hairs, what testing has been done on them, how can we be sure that they come from the same. So I think it's actually made juries more skeptical of science than the other way around.
Yeah, debunked science.
One of the other debunked sciences was something called forensic odontology, where they would look at bite marks on skin. And of course, skin is not a medium for it's flexible, it's pliable, it goes back into shape. But they were looking at bite marks on skin, and then matching them to the perpetrator. And again, that's been a science that's been completely debunked. You cannot do that. And there have been exonerations based on the fact that the conviction relied on that forensic odontology.
So, just because we're over our allotted time, I think I'll go to our last question here, which is, what do you see on the horizon in terms of maybe forensic science breakthroughs? Are there any changes with how the work you're doing at the Rocky Mountain Innocence Center is being done? And what would you guys both like to see changed in terms of maybe systemic changes, but also the process by which you guys do your work?
It's very, very exciting when we get an exoneration, and we work very hard to achieve those. But really, what we'd like to accomplish is, on the front end, to prevent a wrongful conviction to begin with. And so I think into the future, there's a lot of advocacy work and legislative work to be done, training and best practices. And that's when we know we're really successful, when we don't have 3-6% of people who are behind bars innocent.
Is that something that you guys can foresee, a future where the process by which convictions occur and the science, the forensic science are you know, so sort of watertight that we won't have these wrongful convictions?
The fact of the matter is people say to us all the time, you know, as science gets better, isn't your work going to end? I mean, isn't the need for this organization going to stop? And quite frankly, we would love that. I mean, we would love it if no innocent people went to prison. But unfortunately, I don't see that happening. In fact, the number of exonerations has increased over the years based on advances in forensic science and based on the fact that so many of these organizations are now looking at the non-DNA cases, the other 90%, if you will. So I don't mean to be skeptical or not optimistic, but I believe that our work will continue for a really long time as we continue to look at different sciences and how they can go wrong, and as we have advances in other sciences. But we still continue, despite the fact that we've really been doing this work nationally for about 20 years, we continue to fight the fight of getting our clients back into court. Utah is the only state in the nation that has that non-DNA testing
statute.
I had the honor of testifying in front of the Wyoming legislature, and they are seriously looking now at a non-DNA statute to be able to allow Wyoming folks back into court if they don't have physical evidence. And we also see a problem with compensation of these individuals. Only 29 states right now have compensation for someone who's been wrongfully convicted. Again, Wyoming is looking at that, and we're very excited about that possibility. Nevada still doesn't have that, as well as 21 other states.
Can I interrupt there? Just the compensation, this is for people who have been exonerated. Most states would just say, you're exonerated, there you go, you're free from prison.
The compensation statutes not only recognize that there's been a wrongful conviction, but what they really recognize is that time in prison is incredibly damaging. You know, as you said, Deborah Brown spent 17 years in prison. Andrew Johnson spent 25 years in prison. It can be an incredibly damaging experience physically, psychologically, professionally. I mean, and to come back out into a world that's absolutely changed since you went in. So compensation statutes not only recognize that these people were wrongfully convicted, but also recognize that they need assistance in getting back into the world. In Deborah Brown's case, she will receive ultimately a payment of about $500,000. She'll get an upfront payment of just over $100,000, and then she'll receive an annuity for the next 10 years. Andrew Johnson will receive no compensation at all. At least that's what it looks like at this point.
I had asked Jennifer about why personally she got involved, but Jenzi, I hadn't asked you why this issue is important to you.
You know, I went to law school to change the world. And when I came out of law school, there were loans to pay, and the law to learn. And so I spent some time in private practice, but ultimately ended up at the University of Utah College of Law teaching. And that's when I met Lionel Frankel. I had done social justice work. I had done impact work, larger impact work, and really realized that I needed to do work that was individually based as well as impact work. And when Lionel offered me the opportunity to be on the original board of the Rocky Mountain Innocence Center, I jumped at the chance. And I immediately fell in love with the work. I took over the organization about a year after Lionel invited me to be on the board because he was ill, and I was president of the board for 10 years until last year, and have done been involved in all of the cases that we've done since that time. And the work is so important. Not only does it affect individuals and their families, but it also really does have the potential of reforming the system. And so it's everything that I could have asked for as a lawyer, and it's the most satisfying work I've ever been able to do.
And jumping back, this will be my final question, actually. What happens to a person after they're exonerated? You talked about that very difficult transition. I mean, the whole world has changed while you've been behind bars. What happens to a person?
Well, I think they face great challenges when they come back into the community, and it's one of our concerns. We're limited in our resources, and so when we have a client who's returning to society, what we can do is help them connect with resources that are out there, whether they're support, counseling support, or financial education support or employment or those kinds of things. We can work to try to connect them with those resources, but we can't do it all.
Right. You guys, how can people get involved?
Well, I'll tell you one way that is a tremendous help, of course, is financial contributions. We are a very small nonprofit organization. Our budget is just over $200,000 annually. We are sustaining 34 cases currently with that. That small amount of money enables us to leverage about $1.5 million in legal services annually, because we rely on partnerships with law students to do the investigatory work on our cases. And then when we're ready to take our cases to court, we turn to attorneys in the community on a pro bono basis. So we welcome people to get involved by following us on Facebook, by visiting our website, by making a contribution. And then for those who are active in the legal community and are interested, please contact us. And if there's a way that we can engage you in one of our cases, we'd be glad to do that.
Wonderful. And what's the website?
It is www.rminnocence.org.
Wonderful. Jennifer Harris-Salem and Jency Anderson, I want to thank you guys for coming in. I would love for this conversation to go on for another hour, to tell you the truth. It's very interesting.
Thank you so
thank
much
you
for having
much.
Us.